The sun is rising on a clean energy age.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was, and always will be First Nations land. At a time in the year when we have National Reconciliation Week and NAIDOC Week very close to each other, it's really important that we continue to emphasise the incredible wealth of ancient wisdom that they accumulated from nurturing both their land and their communities for millennia before their land was stolen. In that ancient wisdom lies many of the answers that we're going to need as we navigate the climate crisis.
Fuels, petrol, becomes more profitable when there's more conflict in the world. Where's the logic in that? Well, what's the most powerful law probably in the world? It's not a law against theft or against violence. Some lawyers say that the most powerful law on earth is the one that requires company directors to act in the best interest of their company. In other words, the law that helps them drive the pursuit of profit. Sure, that's helped build businesses and industries, prosperity, wealth. But it's also a law which basically says that if a company can profit, even though it's causing harm to people, even though it's about, you know, a war or ecosystems that are being destroyed, well, then that's okay. We have a legal system that actually rewards companies doing the wrong things. It's okay, according to the law, that they are wrecking the climate. And now we're seeing oil and gas companies once again making enormous windfall profits. Profits that arrive not through some innovation or some hard work that they're doing, but because there's a war, there's instability, and that pushes up energy prices. And meanwhile, the climate keeps changing. We're seeing now in Europe extreme heat and so on. But before I get too deep into that, that's why we have Colin Mockett, OAM, ready with what's happening around the world. We'll be talking more about the law today. We have a lawyer who knows about climate legislation and corporate responsibility and so on. And it'll be interesting to have a chat about how we could protect life on this planet in a better way than we are at the moment with the laws that we have. But over to you, Colin Mockett. What do you have for us today?
Yes, thank you, Mick. My roundup this week begins with the six winners of the Green Nobel Prizes. They were announced a week ago, and for the first time in the awards history, they were all awarded to women. They were in, no particular order, really. The North American went to an Alaskan lady by the name of Alana Hurley, who helped block a massive mining project to protect Bristol Bay. That's the home of 50 million wild salmon and one of the last intact ecosystems of its kind in the world. So that was the Americas. Then in Africa, Nigerian Iroro Tanshi protected an endangered bat species by building a community wildfire prevention network that now keeps more than 1,000 hectares of forest safe from fires. In Asia, South Korean Borim Kim led Asia's first successful youth-driven climate lawsuit, coming up with a ruling that would prevent up to 2 billion tons of CO2, roughly 3 years of her country's entire emissions, from entering our atmosphere. In our region of Asia, Papua New Guinean Thianula Roca Mabob held mining giant Rio Tinto accountable for dumping 150,000 tons of toxic waste a day from the abandoned Panguna mine. The European prize went to the UK, where Sarah Finch took two oil companies to the Supreme Court and won. Her ruling meant that Shell and Equinor now have to disclose the carbon emissions that will be produced by their Jackdaw gas field. And this essentially forces UK to account for all the damage a fossil fuel project causes. And it's already blocking the dirtiest projects from getting off the ground. And finally, the South American prize went to Colombian Yuvelis Morales Blanco, who helped stop commercial fracking after an oil spill devastated her community. Her youth movement drove the court rulings that blocked the projects for good. So congratulations to all of those significant women. Each of them received $200,000 prize from the Goldman Foundation to continue their works. Now to Indonesia, where a new report named that nation as the most at risk from climate change in our region. And it's already begun, according to the report's author, that's Dr. Robert Glasser of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. His report, that's titled Lethal Humidity and the Systemic Risks of Climate Change, said that lethal warnings had begun in the region, and it could rapidly escalate to cause massive population displacements in Indonesia. It warned that the Indonesian government to plan for cascading disasters around the region. The report said that the biggest threat was from lethal humidity caused by the twin rise of heat and humidity, which robs people's bodies of their main cooling mechanisms, that's perspiration, and evaporative heat loss. Heat stress is already a major cause of death in Indonesia. There, the government warns that heat waves lead to more deaths than any other natural hazard. It's routinely killing hundreds of people during each event. Children and people over 65 are particularly at risk. And the report held a warning for Australians too. I wonder how many Australians realise that each year heat kills more people than all Australians who were killed in the Vietnam War, Glasser said. In fact, it's something like five times more than all the Australians killed in the Vietnam War, annually dying from heat stress in Australia. And he named the Northern Territory, Northern South Australia and Queensland as the hotspots. No pun intended. But without doubt, the country most at risk in our region is Indonesia, the report said, where humidity is already high in both the wet and dry seasons. It's really remarkable what an overlapping centre of climate hazard Indonesia is, Glasser said. It also has the fastest sea level rises in the world. It has the largest exposure to a range of natural hazards, many of which climate is amplifying. Indonesia, on Australia's doorstep, is a huge risk from these issues. Dr. Glasser previously served as United Nations Secretary General's Special Representative for Disaster Reduction and as Secretary General for aid organisation CARE International. His report was funded by Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation. It also warned that Southeast Asia and the Indo-Gangetic Basin, which takes in northern India and parts of Pakistan, Nepal and Bangladesh, were at imminent danger from the same heat risks. Now to Europe, where a heat wave has gripped several nations, including the UK, providing advanced warning of what is expected to be an extreme northern hemisphere summer. It's still only spring over there. A high-pressure heat dome, which warms air as it compresses it towards the ground, is forecast to linger over Britain, France and Spain and push temperatures up to 11 degrees above normal. That's what their weather models are predicting. The British Met Office said temperatures had already broken spring UK records, parts of Greater London and South East England recorded up to 34 degrees in the last couple of weeks. And Tom Morgan, meteorologist with the UK Met Office, told the London Telegraph, "We rarely see temperatures above 35 degrees, even in the summer months. So to see temperatures getting close to 35 degrees in May is pretty historic." This came at a time when Europe was named as the fastest warming continent, heating at twice the global average rate, with 2.5 degrees of warming since pre-industrial times, the European Union's Copernicus Observation Service reported. Meanwhile, the US National Weather Service this week warned the chances of an El Nino emerging between May and July at 82%, and the chances of it lingering through to December to February at 96%. And finally, a press release from the Chinese car manufacturer BYD reported that it is currently turning out right-wheel drive electric vehicles, one every 90 seconds. That means they're aimed at the former British colonies, the UK and former British colonies, of which Australia is one. And there was a report on Monday of this week which said that the BYD ship was in Melbourne unloading 50,000 electric vehicles. And the current figure from the Australian motor industry is that Australians are buying electric vehicles at the rate of one every 3 minutes. Now, that's a fact that needs checking, and I will be checking it, and I'll be bringing it up in the future. But it's a nice note to leave this week's report.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Bruce Lindsay from Environmental Justice Australia. Bruce is the nature lead at that organisation. He specialises in planning law, water, biodiversity law and related fields. As well as a law degree, Bruce holds a PhD in administrative law, a BA honours and Masters of Environmental Science. Oh, there's a bit of work gone into those. He has worked previously as a student advocate, a project officer at Trust for Nature, and a lecturer in law at Deakin University. Bruce, welcome to the Sustainable Hour.
Morning, Tony. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Pleasure. So tell us your story. What's up front for you and EJA at the moment?
Yeah, well, given that backstory, that bio is probably a little dated, but it's still relatively valid, so I'll proceed from it.
Yeah.
So Environmental Justice Australia, or we'll just refer to it as EJA, is where I've worked for most of the last, I think, nearly 14 years, 13 and a half years, so more than a decade, with a little time off in between last year, which may be a side story. EJA is essentially a public interest environmental legal practice. It came out of what was once the Environment Defenders Office in Victoria, still technically a community legal centre, but I've always described it as something between a legal practice and an environmental NGO. But our real project and our real task is to use the law in as many ways as we can to achieve protection and improvements to nature and to the environment and to the communities that depend and rely on a healthy and resilient environment. That's the kind of the core, really, of what EJA is about. There's different ways in which we, to use an appropriate metaphor, prosecute that task. We do go to court quite a lot, so we litigate primarily on behalf of community groups, environmental NGOs, First Nations organisations and individuals. They're our main client base, so we don't work for corporations, we don't work for government. It's an independent institution, EJA. And when I say public interest, primarily our efforts and our purpose is to work with our partners, community partners, environmental partners, traditional owner partners, to protect the public good. The public good in our exercise is, you know, environmental health, as I said, and environmental resilience. And that's kind of always been central to the purpose and the task of EJA and the EDO. Like I said, we have different strings to our bow in this respect that the law provides us as an institution and a vehicle, litigation being one of them, but we also quite heavily involved in advocacy, so public advocacy and using the law, changing the law where it's deficient, and in many respects it is deficient when we're talking about environmental protection, environmental management. It's also often deficient. You might have good laws on the books, but it's often deficient in terms of the administration of the law and how the law is used. And we also see our role as informing the public and educating the public about environmental law and how it can be used and how it needs to be improved and so forth. So that's part of the advocacy exercise as well. Just in terms of a bit more of the backstory of the organisation generally, it's worth bearing in mind. So EJA has grown quite significantly, even in my time here. So when I started at what was then the EDO, there was maybe 6 or 7 staff, and there's now more than 40. We have three main legal teams as well as an operational or administrative team. So the main areas of legal work are around nature, which is the team I lead, which is biodiversity, and I'll come back to that, some specifics of that in a minute. There's also a climate team, so they're the team primarily dealing with issues of climate change, fossil fuel industries and emissions and so forth. And then we have a justice team whose central focus now is really about working with traditional owners and Aboriginal communities to achieve justice on country and for country. So they're the main fields of work. And the way we've come to those areas of work is a number of years ago, we took the step, this is really stepping out of the EDO and becoming EJA, we couldn't simply operate in a reactive or a responsive way with people coming to us with concerns and issues. That happens a little bit still, but we clearly took the approach, and it's very well embedded practically in the organisation now, of functioning strategically and saying, well, we have to take a strategic approach to these issues in order to identify clearly, consciously, and including with our partners and clients, what should be the focus areas of our work, because there's no shortage of the work, right? There's always going to be more need and more demand for environmental lawyers working in this space than we can reasonably fulfill. So we took it on ourselves to function in a strategic manner over a 3-year strategic planning cycle, and that's what we routinely do. And we're in the next financial year, we'll be coming to the end of a strategic planning cycle and then doing a new one. So we every 3 years, we go through an approach of identifying what should we be doing and why should we be doing it and with whom. Because that's, in our view, the central part of the exercise is what's going to give us the biggest bang for our buck. That is to say, what can we achieve in terms of impact in the world. So that's the main raison d'etre in some ways in the way that we work now.
It seems to me, Bruce, it couldn't be more important. We see so much frustration in society in general, you know, lots of people protesting and so on. But the work you do, that's really to the core of where change can be created, you know, when we change the law. So how is it going, for instance, with the big discussion there was about that we were getting a new environment revision or update recently? What was the outcome of that?
The issue in terms of organisation, I think, is crucial in terms of making it different. I just want to go to this point because I think both strategy and purpose and organisation are fundamental to the issues of actually making a change or dealing with very substantial issues in the world. And we're only dealing with the environmental ones, but obviously there's a whole lot of others. To go to your question about recent changes to environmental law, and I should say, amongst the areas that I work with in my team, in the nature team, is environmental law reform. So national environmental law reform falls within our team. And just as an aside, because we may come to it, we deal also with the issue of forest protection, water law in the Murray-Darling Basin in particular, and also working around the Northern Territory savannah lands, which are under pretty severe threat from agro-industrialisation, especially from the cotton industries. There's a lot of land clearing going up in the north, and we work a lot there. Just to go back to your question about environmental law reform. So last year, the federal parliament and the federal government passed probably the most substantial changes to federal environmental law since the late 1990s, early 2000s. They reformed the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, which is our main national environmental law. Those changes, I would suggest, it was at the end of a long arc of, you know, a process of reform and advocacy and reviews and things like this. I'd suggest the outcome of that process has been, at best, a very mixed bag. At worst, I think there's every chance the situation can slide backwards from where we were before. And unfortunately, where we were before, the EPBC Act, I think on the face of it and on paper, had some real strengths and some real power. But its implementation administration was always a real serious shortcoming and a real failure. I mean, there were some gaps in the law itself, which really did need to be addressed and were the target of the reform process. But what's happened in the reforms that came out late last year is that it created certain potential steps forward and some real serious potential steps backwards. And when I say potential, what has happened is that partly the way the law has been reformed is to create more of a framework for decision making. And by the federal, like the key decision maker is the federal minister, environment minister. And a lot of the way in which that framework is to be implemented now is currently being designed and prepared as we speak through the course of this year. So some of the real issues and shortcomings in the past were that you would have relatively strong protections on paper, but there are a lot of workarounds that proponents, especially, you know, corporations and so forth, wanting to do environmental damage were able to achieve through the way which decisions were made and the laws were actually administered. So, for instance, by embedding things like offsetting into the law, which is the offsetting being kind of a purported type of compensation for environmental damage, which in my view has very rarely achieved any real compensation or balance to the damage at all. Those mechanisms were widely used in practice under the law, though they didn't exist under the law before. Now, in the framework, the changes that have occurred now, they've actually been embedded in the law itself. So there's some real, and another example is there was the real need for some much more prescriptive standards around how decisions were to be made under environmental law. And so out of the reform package last year, we got what I've called national environmental standards, which in principle would be very good if indeed high standards were drafted and there's a high benchmark to which proponents are to be held. Now, unfortunately, what we're seeing on the table at the moment is not high standards, they're in fact quite low standards and very probably workarounds that you could drive proverbially drive a truck through. So these kind of things are a bit exemplary of how environmental law has tended to work. You have good laws on paper, their administration and implementation has the very severe shortcomings.
So what you're saying is we're yet to see actually any impact, any effect in the real world from this reform.
Yeah, in terms of the reform that's happened, we're partly yet to see any impacts in the world because the laws are not in effect and they don't become, well, most of them aren't yet in effect. They will be in effect in the course of the end of this year and through next year. And that's partly a staged change to the law because they're quite substantial and that's fine. Staged change is fine, but you still, the concern that I'm raising is in substance. Once the laws, these new changes actually come into place, they will have profound weaknesses and shortcomings to them, which won't, I should say, the key concern, that they will not enhance environmental performance. They'll continue a backsliding in environmental performance of this country.
We're speaking with Bruce Lindsay from Environmental Justice Australia. Bruce, I think we all know what you're talking about, that that our politicians water down every single law. The real point is, what can we do about it?
Well, from our point of view, what we endeavour to do in particular as lawyers is use the laws that we have to actually try, because often the issue is not actually using the laws that are on the books or not seeking to push them as far as they can go. So we'll do that, and we do that. That's kind of our day job. And sometimes those things can have real outcomes in the world, right? The courts are often receptive to interpretational reading of laws that may be quite strong but are simply poorly implemented. So if we are taking on behalf of the community or environmental interests or whatever, seeking to apply those laws in a particular circumstance, the courts may have a far better sense of how they should be implemented than the executive government. Or indeed, part of the issue is often having them implemented at all.
Is there any way that we can refer to some laws that are offshore for us? Some countries, I'm thinking now of the Scandinavian countries, where they have much tougher environmental laws than we do. Can we not point to them and say, hey, why don't we do this?
Well, yes, and we do. You can point to laws all over the world, and some are stronger than others. That's useful for purposes of advocacy, for example. And we often will use, for example, this might seem a bit odd in the circumstances, but American environmental laws, US environmental laws, have historically been very strong and quite powerful and quite world-leading, and have informed Australian environmental law over the years as well. So there are examples from other jurisdictions that we use in design of laws in Australia. It's also worth bearing in mind that Australia, the EPBC Act in particular, and a lot of our environmental laws are actually founded on treaties. So international law, which is to say law that Australia has signed up to along with, you know, dozens and dozens of other countries, most of the international community, underpin a lot of our laws now. And those international laws are quite good and quite strong. And part of the issue goes into how they are incorporated into Australian law and then how they are used. Like I said, this is a bit of a cascading issue. Some of the laws are quite good. The international basis of some of the laws that we use is quite good, and we do use the standards and the provisions under international law to hold Australian law to account as well. So those other areas of law are not irrelevant. They're quite important and significant. As I said, often the issue is in the implementation and the use of the laws.
Wouldn't it maybe be more efficient to focus on the Business Act rather than an Environmental Act? And I say that because typically the damage done to nature, damage done to environment, is not you and me. You know, it's not individuals. It's typically big corporations that come in and do major projects. And then, you know, as a result of that, they also have a lot of emissions that damage the climate, which comes back in terms of extreme weather events and hits all of us. So isn't the place to be focused on for you guys, the lawyer team, the Business Act? Isn't that where the change needs to happen?
Well, I'd suggest the focus of attention of environmental law, public interest environmental law, is probably all of those things. So the general environmental law that I've been talking about, you certainly got a role to play, and that's obviously been a focus of my work. But you're right, there's other spheres of law that in many ways are probably underdeveloped in respect of environmental obligations and preventing environmental harm and compelling environmental recovery or restoration. So just to take your example of companies. Yeah, companies are typically proponents, I should say, when we're dealing with environmental decisions and the application of environmental law. But curiously, the basic underpinning law of companies itself has very little to say about the environment or environmental protection. As far as corporations law tends to go, it's not necessarily my area of expertise, but it's things like ESG standards and ESG reporting and things like that, which are usually kind of guidance mechanisms and best practice approaches in t- to how corporations are supposed to be governed and supposed to be run. But that's a bit, that's obviously can be quite fast and loose, to say the least, and often is just simply a matter of greenwashing. And there has been quite a lot of court cases, both here in Australia and overseas, over corporations taking precisely that approach. So there are environmental law firms who are tackling corporations from the angle of corporations law itself, which I think is very important and very novel. I should say, when we go to the heart of corporations, though, and how corporations are run, such as issues like directors' duties, so who are fiduciaries for corporations and those who run corporations, there's very little or nothing within those duties that require them to adhere to environmental standards or environmental protections as per se, as directors of corporations. Their fundamental obligations or to discharge are around things like the profitability of companies and the financial viability of companies and making sure they're not insolvent and things like that. Clearly all important things if you're running a company. There has been attempts over the years to try and bring within the scope of either statute or common law the wider set of obligations that include obligations to protect or not harm the environment. I entirely agree that it would be a very, very powerful mechanism to bring within the scope of corporations law and everyday business activities the requirement for those running corporations to adhere to environmental protections and not harm the environment. I mean, there's other ways that this occurs, I would imagine, through reporting and so forth, but it's not at the heart.
Well, it would seem that, you know, sometimes even the way things are now, the directors actually are forced to harm the environment because, you know, they have to protect their shareholders.
Look, that may well, very well might be the case in a lot of circumstances, indeed most circumstances. And, you know, like I said, it's not really my area of expertise, but certainly there would be, it would be a pretty profound change and would have pretty significant import to bring those kind of duties, environmental duties, within the scope of what directors have to discharge as directors.
Mm. Well, if you want to become a doctor, your very first law, or the very first thing you sign up to, is a rule that says, first, do no harm. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get lawyers and lawmakers to include that at the very beginning of whatever they do, whatever they take up?
Sure, I entirely agree. I think that's partly what our environmental laws are intended to achieve. And, you know, they do that through mechanisms that are designed in certain ways and only account for certain things. So, yeah, I mean, I obviously agree in principle with what you're saying, Colin.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies. On climate, we have to face facts. The facts are grim and the stakes are high.
They sold the truth for a shipload of coal, turned their lies into a platform for oil, constructed pipelines where dark money could flow, pulled the strings so they could rewrite the rules.
They bought the judges and the media too, so when the rivers rose and storms grew dangerous, we were asleep, we didn't know what was going on, but we saw the sky turn red and suddenly all the fish were dead.
Time away.
Storm is coming.
Time to wake up. This is a battle we need to win.
Driven by climate upheaval.
It's the battle between truth and science
and power and lies. We are sailing toward economic catastrophe.
They dressed up greed in a righteous disguise. Built their fortunes on a thousand lies. The silence of elected leaders wrote the rules that protected their business. But hey, science speaks and our children know we can't
climate upheaval. We have badly let down our people. And as the result of that failure, we've now entered the era of consequences, when the stuff that was so predicted is now starting to actually happen in people's lives. Heading into that storm unprepared while being lied to at industrial scale.
Bruce, taking the very public stance that EJA takes on environmental law and the litigation that they've been involved in, has that created any litigation? Like, has there been any litigation against EJA at all?
Well, I mean, there's probably two ways to respond to that. One is, by definition, when you're dealing with the law and you're dealing with legal disputes, you're dealing with opponents. You're dealing with what we would call in law controversies. So that, especially in litigation, by definition, you're often dealing with very fierce litigants or fierce opponents on the other side. And that's often because you are tackling relatively wealthy and powerful interests. That's often the case. So you could consider that they're your opponents, legal opponents. Do we collect enemies as well, as in, which is a bit of a pejorative term, but do we collect enemies in terms of people who would like to shut us down, like to do us harm? Well, yes, probably. But I think that's, you know, you're going to have opponents who would be fiercely attempting to attack EJA directly, and we have had colleagues in other organisations or other organisations like ours attack directly to try and shut them down, or at least impose substantial burdens or harms to them through litigation processes. There's the whole area of what we call slap suits, which is strategic litigation against public participation. And, you know, we have to factor those kind of matters into how we function all the time. But I think that there's, on the other side of the coin, you will have fierce opponents and people who will fiercely resist what we do. But I think, at least for the time being, what gives us considerable encouragement and resolve, I would suggest, is, in this country, at least, there is still a very strong respect for the rule of law. And the rule of law is kind of quite integral to the type of work that we do. It's obviously about protecting and protecting the environment, but it's also about ensuring that the law is respected. There are good laws, for a start, and that the law is respected. And the law is the basis of a democratic society and is a properly functioning civil and democratic society. That may be sliding in other countries. Who knows? It may well slide here. But at the same time, I think at the present time, there still maintains in this country a very strong respect for the rule of law, and we will work with that and use that as a basis for our work going forward.
On this program, we have had many organizations, actually. I'm thinking back, we've had last week Footballers for the Environment. We've spoken to Doctors for the Environment. We've spoken to Teachers for the Environment. Would you describe your organization, EJA, as lawyers for the environment?
Possibly. I think we have a bit of a slogan. I can't quite remember what it is on our website about being the voice for the environment. something like that, or a voice for the environment. So that description is probably not entirely inappropriate.
So when you have justice in the name, is that justice for nature, justice for the animals, justice for the plants?
Yeah, but it's also justice for people. So I think it has to be justice for people, and it, because at the end of the day, the questions of social and democratic justice are entirely entwined with the question of the environment and of the health and protection of the environment on which people rely. I mean, that can be as simple as having some natural places with a degree of integrity that people can go for their own respite, but it can go be far more extreme for that and can be about prosecuting harms about serious, irreversible destruction of the environment on which people rely. I mean, there are extreme examples of this in terms of destruction of what mining company, destruction of country in Australia, all the way through to what is happening in war zones and the complete obliteration of environment, such as happening in Gaza and in southern Lebanon and places like that now. So these questions of the social dimension of environments and the environments as nature themselves are entwined questions.
Can I take you back again to your position as lawyers for the environment? Have you had any notable victories in court that you're proud of?
Yeah, and at different scales. So probably the more famous or notorious or spectacular examples in recent times was a series of very high-profile cases in both Victorian and federal courts in opposition to logging in Victorian forests, broad-scale logging in Victorian forests, which through a series of cases which were run by EJA, and there were other cases run by other legal firms as well, those logging operations conducted by a Victorian government agency in particular were largely found to be unlawful and halted. And over a period of many years, well, and there's been the issue of conflicts over forest and logging have been going for decades, but certainly in the last decade we ran some high profile cases that have contributed to the fact that the logging of our native forests, of high conservation value pristine native forests, has largely ended. Well, there's still workarounds happening, but the official logging of native forests in this state at scale has ended, and that was not in substantial part due to colleagues here at EJA running some very complex, very important cases around that issue. There's been, specifically, I've kind of run smaller scale cases around things like native vegetation clearing to protect, you know, remnant important areas of biodiversity in the state, which have been successful. So some cases we win, there have been cases that we lose as well. Because you can't win them all. We do try to balance out cases that we think have got prospects of success combined with cases that and issues that we think are just important and need to be run. So, yeah, that's a bit of the calculations that go into how we function.
I first came to Geelong in the early 1980s, and then there was a huge environmental campaign under the title of Don't Chip the Otways. And it was chipping. It was
logging,
culling, old growth forest. Yeah, logging in the Otway ranges in order to provide Japan with wood chips. And it pains me every time I go to North Geelong to see the pile of wood chips that are there at Midway, all going to be loaded onto what are essentially tankers, ships, huge ships taking it off to Japan. And this is what, 50 years later. I sometimes absolutely despair when I think of the inability of our lawyers to actually take on the money, because that's what it is. It's the huge money involved that you're up against. I mean, this is no way in order to sort of disparage your efforts, but by golly, usually tend to get away with whatever they want to do, whether it be drilling for oil, because, I mean, only 2 weeks ago they said they've opened up a new drilling for oil off of the Otways again, which is still being chipped. Whatever they seem to want to do, they seem to be able to do it by outskirting the laws that are put in place. That's just a comment, I'm aware, but I wouldn't mind hearing your comments on that.
Well, I think that comment goes to both partly the design and the response to the law. So laws are designed, environmental laws are typically designed in quite complex and convoluted ways to balance conflicting forces. Environmental protection on the other hand, and development and resource extraction on the other hand. That's more a statement of how they're actually designed rather than how I think they should be designed. Both those issues that you mentioned, offshore gas extraction or oil extraction and logging or timber extraction, fall within that kind of category. They're resource extraction activities to which the law has been designed to enable those activities to occur, but to occur under certain limits and constraints. Now, the issue with logging that I just mentioned before, in partly, it's not really a feasible economic industry anymore, but it was continuing anyway, even beyond, certainly beyond ecological limits, but even beyond economic ones. That's partly why the logging in the Otways ended as well, simply was no longer economic, as well as being ecologically destructive. So the law has a role, or had a role in those circumstances, of managing and controlling those activities. It's not necessarily a panacea, I should say. Like, I would certainly advocate for many environmental laws to be a lot stronger than they are. But as lawyers, of course, we can use the law, we can advocate for changes to the law, but it's the parliament and executive government that largely design the laws and implement them. So we would continue to be critics of where those laws are deficient. And in the examples that you cite, the law has often turned out to be deficient. But in certain circumstances, I think lawyers have had a role. I think there's been many other factors at play here. Lawyers have had a role in ensuring that the environmental content of those laws at least gets the best airing that it can. But as lawyers, we of course have to work with the laws that are there. And the laws that are there are very frequently either deficient in design or deficient in their application.
Bruce Lindsay from Environmental Justice Australia has been our guest today in the Sustainable Hour. And thank you very much, Bruce, for enlightening us what's happening in the space of law. Now, if listeners would like to contribute or do something, be more active in this field where you're in, how can they engage with EJA?
Well, obviously EJA is putting a lot of material out in the world on social media and things like that. I would point out EJA is overwhelmingly a donor-driven organisation. So we rely on public funds and donated funds simply to function. And obviously we've become a reasonably large organisation for one of our type, so it costs a lot of money to keep everyone in employment and keeping the operation running. So you should certainly consider donating to EJA as well. But follow our work. You can join our member lists and things like that, so you'll be updated routinely on what is going on. If you are within community groups, environmental NGOs, they're mostly our clients and partners that we work with. So being active in environmental organisations, I think, is also an important contributor to the type of work that we do when those organisations need lawyers.
Rounding off, we have come to the very famous B section of the Sustainable Hour, where we talk about, you know, should we be the change? Should we be the difference? What do you say, Bruce? What should we be from a lawyer's point of view?
I think you should be one of our clients or a member of a group that is one of our clients.
Like the sun, the election is on. From the streets to the courtrooms, we call out the patriarchs. No one, no rule, no scaremongering lies can hold who we are. Don't try to silence me, I'm not afraid of you. I know your system, I can see through your gaze. We are a movement, and we are strong. We're firm on truth and integrity. Women and girls, this is our day. Trust in the science, leading the way. No more corruption. Try to silence.